The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, Space Show listeners. Welcome back to the program, and hello to everyone again in the greater KKNW Seattle audience. Great to be here. Let me tell you about our program today, make a few announcements, and then get right into business. Our toll-free number, if you would like to call and talk to our guest, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let the phone ring until it can be answered, and we'll bring you up on air just as soon as possible. If you prefer email, the 3 addresses that are up and running, drspace@thespaceshow.com, thespaceshow@gmail.com, and dmlivings@yahoo.com. Chat is on the AOL family with IM, ICQ, and CompuServe, and the screen name remains the same for all 3 of those services. One word, Space Show Chat. Remember, we are trademarked and copyrighted, but you do have permission to download shows, copy them, distribute them, put them on memory sticks, DVDs, CDs to get the word out as to why space is important. Please don't do any business or commercial activities with the show, and no changes or modifications to the text of the interview. You're welcome to copy and to quote and to reference these shows. We prefer that you do so with an actual academic citation. If you don't know how to do that for an online radio show, send me an email and I'll be happy to give you the format for an online citation in an academic format. Special thanks to Andrew and Gigadial. They do our podcasting service. The RSS URL is on our website and both of our newsletters. We are iTunes compatible. Search for The Space Show or my name, David Livingston. We're in Podcast Alley, and we're on lots of other ones, including, I believe it's Astrospace Now in Argentina. So check us out and subscribe to our podcast. Please note also that at thespaceshow.com, our comprehensive newsletter is uploaded early Monday morning, California time. It has all of the bios and the details of the programs for the week, plus the coming events section. It's also where we make announcements and change programming if we have to change any. So check it out from time to time to stay current. We also have a very short email newsletter that we can send out, 1 or 2 lines about the week's programming, guaranteed not to clutter up your inbox. So if you want to subscribe, send your request to drspace@thespaceshow.com. And everything we do is archived, going back to 2001. Listen to these shows off of our website, or they're easy to download and put them on your own computer. No restrictions on that, no login, no registration either. We have a store on our website. Check it out. And above all, you'll see the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with One Giant Leap Foundation. We could not do this show without your support. We appreciate your support. And thank you very much for those of you who have supported us and those of you who will be supporting us in the future. And please remember, the Space Show is brought to you in part by Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, visit secureworldfoundation.org. So I would like to tell you about today's program, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it as much as I'm looking forward to talking to our 2 guests. When I was at the SmallSat conference, and I was at the Microsoft book booth, I noticed a new AIAA book, Small Satellites Past present, and future, by two authors, Dr. Siegfried Janssen and Dr. Henry Helvajian. And I thumbed through the book and said, this has got to be a plus for the space show. So the guests that we have with us are the two authors, Dr. Janssen and Dr. Helvajian. I'll tell you about them in just a minute. Both are with the Aerospace Corporation. And for those of you who aren't that familiar with the Aerospace Corporation, it has provided independent technical and scientific research, development, and advisory services to national security space programs since the 1960s. They are operate as a federally funded research and development center for the U.S. Air Force and the National Reconnaissance Office, and they support all national security space programs. And they've been around for, well, longer than I've been around in the space community, let's put it that way. And our two authors are with the Aerospace Corporation. Dr. Siegfried Janssen is a senior scientist in the micro nanotechnology department at the Aerospace Corporation, and his current research interests are microthrusters, micro nano electromechanical systems for spacecraft, nano pico, let's see if I get this right, femtosatellite, formation flying, and distributed space systems. He invented the silicon nanosatellite in 1989, has published over 15 papers on their propulsion requirements, basic design issues, and orbital architecture. His full bio will be up on the website. Dr. Henry Helvajian is a senior scientist at the Aerospace Corporation, and he runs the Laboratory for Laser Microengineering Science. And his full bio will be up on the website, too. And their book is on the One Giant Leap website, where you can get it as an Amazon partner and support the space show as well. And it is quite the book to have and to understand. So, Dr. Janssen and Dr. Helvajian, welcome to the space show. How are you both today? Can you hear me?
Thank you to be on. Pleasure.
Let's start out and I guess, Dr. Janssen, maybe we should start out. Let me make one other thing. The Aerospace Corporation is going to give away two books during this show. So for those of you listening live, the books go to people who call in with a comment or question. 1-866-687-7223. If nobody calls in near the end of the show, I may be generous and open that up to email or chat questions, but certainly that will be available for email questions on archives and podcasts. But if you would like this book, and I completely recommend it, then call in again, 1-866-687-7223. Dr. Janssen, let's start out, and can you give us sort of a 101 history on small satellites, so we'll be able to understand where we came from with it, and then as we talk about what's going on with new technologies in the future, at least we'll have that good background.
Okay, sure. But to start, I'd like to say that Henry and I are the editors of the book, not the authors.
Okay.
We wrote various chapters, but we didn't write the whole thing. It's over 800 pages. And we have 24 chapters, an international cast of authors. We couldn't possibly do the whole book, write it out by ourselves. Having gotten that out of the way, the small satellite era actually started at the start of the space era. The first satellite launch, Sputnik, was an 84-kilogram spherical satellite. And in today's classification, we'd call that a microsatellite. Satellites between a mass of about 10 and 100 kilograms are microsatellites. If you go down in size to nanosatellites, that's 1 to 10 kilograms. And picosatellites right now are 0.1 to 1 kilograms in mass. Mass of our book, for those of you that buy it, is about 1.5 kilograms.
And welcome back, everybody. We had a little technical glitch there, but we are back. And Siegfried, you were giving us sort of the 101 history of small satellites.
Yeah, I think I was talking about the mass ranges of satellites.
Correct.
The current classification levels. And I'll do it backwards. Femtosats are really small satellites. They're under 0.1 kilograms in mass. We've got the picosats, which are 0.1 to 1 kilograms in mass. Then you have your nanosats, which are 1 to 10 kilograms, and microsats from 10 to 100. Unfortunately, that doesn't follow the standard of a factor of 1,000 between the different Greek prefixes, but that's the way things evolved. But getting back to the beginning, the first satellite was Sputnik that most Americans and people all over the planet, particularly Russians, know about. Had a mass of 84 kilograms, followed by Sputnik 2, which was a bit heavier at 508. That's no longer Microsat. And the United States, our first two satellites were Explorer 1 at 14 kilograms and Vanguard at 1.7. Right now, Vanguard 1 is the oldest man-made object in space, and it's a nanosatellite. So you can say a lot of positive things about nanosatellites. The launch vehicles that put satellites into space got mightier. The throw weight into orbit increased over time, basically because we were focused more on manned missions, getting man into space. And satellites tended to follow that. The available mass that was in those rockets. So masses increased during the first 10, 20 years, and actually they continued to increase for the most part since the start of the space age. A lot of your initial satellites, though, were microsats. A lot of the commsats, like Telstar, were microsats. A lot of the military initial satellites, test communication satellites, were microsatellites. Things like Echo, which was a large Mylar balloon, that actually was a microsatellite, even though it was about 100 feet in diameter. The bottom line, though, is that satellites tended to get more complex as we learned more about the space environment. The really small satellites, the ones we're interested in today, the micros and nanos, those were used for research, learning about space, learning how to build attitude control systems, and the operational systems tended to be heavier. Now, in general, all of this continued. We had more and more space flights of small satellites until we hit about the mid-70s to mid-80s. That's what I call the small satellite doldrums. At that point, the space race was 20 or so years old. And interestingly enough, inflation was really high, at least in the United States. Large satellites tended to dominate, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, realized that, maybe we should start thinking about smaller satellites. All this while, there were groups putting up small satellites. Basically, any country that wanted to get into the space business started out with a microsat, or smaller, using someone else's launch vehicle. And there were groups like AMSAT, the Amateur Satellite Corporation, that was putting up small satellites for amateurs. DARPA realized that small satellites could play a role, especially if large satellites had issues or if too much money was spent on large satellites. Sometimes you needed a more responsive capability. So they started what they call light sats. And there were several microsats in this class range, 68 kilogram GLOMR, Global Low Earth Orbit Message Relay, was one example. There's a set of seven or eight called microsat, not very unique. But those showed the way, and meanwhile, a lot of people were thinking about, electronics has come a long way since the start of the space age. So things like transistorized radios were coming out in the 60s, things were getting smaller, we had microprocessors that were invented, and that enabled packing a lot of functionality into ever smaller satellites. And what we saw was that in about the late 80s, early 90s, a number of people were looking at, hey, let's build small satellites because we can, basically. We can make things that are in the 100-kilogram class that are basically a flying personal computer, and that kind of started things going, restarted that in the small satellite era. That's continued up until about, say, maybe 10 years ago when we at the aerospace and others realized, you can go an order of magnitude smaller in size. So now, nano and pico satellites started becoming popular. And today we're at the point where we have lots of small satellites being launched. We have typically about seven or eight pico satellites launched per year and maybe about 10 to 20 microsatellites launched per year. And that's actually a pretty good rate if you look at things historically. And I think I've rambled on a little, so I'll give Henry a chance to say something here.
Let me just announce one more time. I have two books to give away on the program, courtesy of the Aerospace Corporation. You need to call the show to win them. 1-866-687-7223. Is there a trend away from the big satellites to the smaller ones? Can you guys spot a trend like that now?
This is Henry. There's no trend. The bigger satellites are there for a reason. There are certain missions that require, physics dictates a lot of what you do in space. And so the big satellites are going to be there, whether they need it for power or observation or other missions. The bottom line is that there is a trend on more sophistication on the smaller satellites. And this is primarily due to the fact that technologies, as Siegfried said, is the miniaturization of the electronics and the integration of systems onto smaller and smaller footprints. You can look at your iPod or your small computer, what it can do. In addition to that, MEMS technology in the 80s, this is micro-electromechanical systems, which is make miniature systems that can actually move and sense and actually conduct specific tasks in addition to providing intelligence on board. That technology has also grown. So the combination of that plus advanced robotics has allowed very sophisticated small satellites to be built these days. And so the trend that I see is that although the footprint's small, small volumes, you're going to see far more capability that's going to be put into a smaller box. And that is definitely going to be a trend. And we hope in the near future, these small systems that could be very small, like Siegfried says, femtosatellites, which are kind of like small probes, could actually do missions in space. Now, they may not live very long in space, but they can actually do specific scientific missions if necessary. The bigger ones on the order of a nanosatellite actually can do missions and can be in space for a very long time, basically depending on the power. But we're being very efficient about how we use power these days. Solar cells have gotten better. The efficiencies have gone up. And people are very smart about the amount of energy that they use on board and the electronics. So things have become very, very smart. And so we're all putting all of these things that you have in your computer or your pocket or your phone, we're putting all of that now, applying it in a more sophisticated way into the harsh conditions of space, which means that they have to be fixable on space. We can't replace them. So there are a lot of redundancies built into it. But we believe that that is the trend that I see. So go ahead.
Well, we have a caller that I'm going to bring up in just a minute. But for those that want to see the launch rate go dramatically up to lower the cost of space access, actually what's happening is the launch rate doesn't need to go up to handle what's happening in satellite technology. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I'll start and see if we can quickly answer. The launch rate does need to go up. More access to space is absolutely necessary. The smaller satellites are effectively orphans at the moment at the whim of the major satellite that's going up. They're piggybacked. And so they don't necessarily pick the orbits, the optimum conditions for them. But in the future, things may change where smaller launch vehicles, I should say, may allow us to be able to put these smaller satellites up in orbit, or a medium-sized launcher could put numerous small satellites in orbit simultaneously. And so I believe that at the moment we are effectively following where the big satellites go, and that will continue to be the case for the next at least 5-10 years. Siegfried?
I generally agree. The small satellites are typically secondary or tertiary payloads. That's true. Basically because we don't have a launch vehicle that'll put 10 kilograms into orbit, just 10 kilograms. And there are a number of economic reasons for that. Primary ones are that it costs a certain amount of money to operate a launch range to fire a rocket off, and the avionics package that you need on a rocket. It's almost independent of how big the rocket is. You still need an inertial navigation unit. You still need communications electronics and onboard processors. You still need to turn rockets on and off and do some steering of the whole vehicle. So that kind of thing doesn't scale that well. And that's why things like the CubeSats were such a great invention, basically using unused space on other people's launch vehicles to get your small satellites into orbit.
Let's see what our caller has real quick. And caller, are you still with us, please?
This is Charles.
Charles, welcome to the show, and I believe I have your address. You win the book. So I have one more copy of the book to give away, listener. This is Charles, everyone in Mojave, California.
And this will go on the main shelf of my library here in the office.
Go ahead with your question.
Anyway, here's the thing. You keep talking about satellites, and in order to develop a high launch rate and to develop access by many people, I think a plan like in micro-launches needs to be pursued, and that is to lead to, say, 100-gram spacecraft to the area among the nearest asteroids to escape. The reason is you cannot tolerate thousands of satellites because of the collision hazards, but between Earth and Mars, you can tolerate thousands of spacecraft. They won't collide. And it's technically possible, and I just heard somebody mentioning the difficulty of avionics and so on. On my website is a description of the Enprise launcher, which is meant to put up a 20-gram satellite, and its guidance requires no gyros, a simple optical system. And this is where a sort of from-the-ground-up space effort ought to go, with very simple mechanisms. There's people now building model airplanes that weigh less than 1 gram. The record now being 225 milligrams. That's electric-powered, two-channel RF. And this is what ought to be encouraged. A launcher could put up, let's say, 1 kilo to LEO, but it'd be self-defeating and have a kind of a dead end built in because you can't clutter space that much. Also, satellites are less useful because they're hidden from view 99% of the time, whereas a spacecraft going out toward an asteroid would be visible any night with a decent telescope, that is to receive its data.
So can you summarize your comment or your question for our guest?
Yeah. Why the fixation on satellites rather than spacecraft? Because I think satellites only make sense if you're talking about dozens, but not thousands.
No, there is no fixation, and in fact, the book, when you get it, you'll see the last two chapters. One of the things the Aerospace Corporation has done here is to look at the development of satellites from the perspective of mass producibility. We have investigated missions where, as you've given an example, there are other missions where hundreds and thousands of systems might be more useful, and the question is, how do you build those things in mass
producibility? But I heard you use the word satellite.
The back end of the book. I'm sorry?
I heard you use the word satellite again.
Yes. Well, I think perhaps we're getting into what a satellite is.
Yeah.
Perhaps what I'm saying is systems. Let me just go back and call it a
spacecraft
to put it in your... A spacecraft. So the last chapter, it's my chapter, and there are other chapters in there, talk about mass producibility. So when you think about making, fabricating spacecraft, and the numbers that are much, much larger than what we talk about these days, you have to look at it from the perspective of changing how spacecraft are completely done, what materials are used, what fabrication tools and technology are available these days. And what I talk about at the end is we have to basically give up things, assembly systems that are commonly used in typical spacecraft toward and go toward the direction of lithography, microelectronics-based fabrication technology to explore the idea of how to make spacecraft in very, very large numbers. So the book does address that, and I believe you're correct. There are clearly missions for very large number of systems. The issue right now is that we have a lot of people who are interested in satellites for the what they can do in low Earth orbit and other space science missions. But there are others who are looking at very large systems or spacecraft.
But a lot can be done in so-called mesoscale, or what I would call wristwatch scale, tiny hand-built mechanisms like these under 1 gram model airplanes. That's where a ground-up garage scale companies can start, and also the launcher is the long pole in the tent, not so much the spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
And
if you
Google the word micro launcher,
because he mentioned
the
idea of femtosat.
I'm sorry? Yeah, well,
the femtosatellite falls in your mass class.
Sure. 100 grams to escape or 1 kilo to LEO, but escape would be the main purpose.
Yeah, the reason we're kind of focused on low Earth orbit for CubeSats and small satellites right now is Well, there are three reasons. The first one being that it just costs less to go into low Earth orbit compared to going onto into an Earth escape trajectory. The cost of Earth escape is probably 2 to 3 times higher than going into low Earth orbit. The reason we stay in low Earth orbit and not high Earth orbit is mainly due to radiation. If you're going to go up into high Earth orbit, you need radiation-tolerant systems. A lot of the commercial off-the-shelf components won't handle that kind of radiation unless you do a lot of special things. And
well, they will
we're
for
about those now.
Gentlemen, hold on a minute. I got to take a break. I'm being prompted with music from KKNW. So everybody stay right where you are. We'll be back in about 2.5 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. You are listening to The Space Show. We're talking about small satellites, past, present, and future. The editors for this book, Dr. Siegfried Janssen and Dr. Henry Helvagian, are with us today. And, gentlemen, I would like to turn our attention to CubeSats and some future technologies, but I want to ask a question first because I'm a teacher at the University of North Dakota as an adjunct in their space studies department, and I guess lecture at a lot of other universities. I know that there are many, many different academic student programs trying to get rides to space for various CubeSats and other things they're doing. Does the academic demand for getting a CubeSat or something into space, does that even show up? Is it even noticeable? Is it even worth our time to talk about?
You want me to start, Siegfried?
Sure, go ahead.
Let me put the book in perspective, Dave, before I answer your question.
Okay.
I will answer your question. This book really presents the case that the academic demand is basically driving a lot of the CubeSat technology, both in terms of as a teaching tool for future spacecraft engineers and scientists, and also developing more sophisticated spacecraft. So the academic demand and the academic work that's going on, and there are several chapters from the Naval Postgraduate School, from SERISAT, and from the Technical University of Berlin, and the Navy schools and the Air Force Academy, that address this issue point blank about how do we handle using a small satellite as a teaching tool. So from that perspective, the academic and the CubeSat box, or the size, if you will, is really doing a lot to showcase what is possible in very small systems, what is possible to put in space, what missions can be accomplished. So I would argue that at the moment it's the academics and the fact that there's a hands-on experience that the teacher not going to offer the students by saying, build your satellite, and here is the kit, we'll assemble it, we'll put it, and for a reasonable cost, we'll get it to orbit, we can do these missions. So it is very important at the moment. It's by no means a small effort. Siegfried?
Thanks, Henry. The last four CubeSats that were launched went up in September, and they're all four of them are from universities. You've got SwissCube, you've got ITU PSAT-1, which is from the Istanbul Technical University, got one from the University of Würzburg in Germany, and you've got BSAT from the Technical University of Berlin. So at least in the CubeSat world, there is a large fraction of it is university-driven at the moment. And just to take that one step further, since you mentioned that you're interested in teaching students and trying to get things into orbit, most people in the CubeSat world know who Bob Twiggs is. He started this whole thing with the 4-inch cube. And he's pushing the Pocket Cube right now, which is basically a 5-centimeter cube. You can fit eight of them into the same volume that a CubeSat takes, what's called a 1U CubeSat. There's a kit available from Astronautical Development. It's about $950 for the complete kit, and I'd estimate the launch cost is probably about $10,000 for something like that. So, you know, you're in the realm now where smaller universities and even high schools can get into the game if they want to. The big open question is bandwidth. You know, that bandwidth is a limited resource. Most CubeSats have used amateur radio frequencies. A number of people at AMSAT have done a heroic job trying to coordinate frequency allocation with the international groups. The only problem I see is if we get too many small satellites, there's got to be either a standardized set of frequencies that they use, or they just have to have really low data rates and very narrow bandwidths. And I'll turn it back to you.
How do you get a ride for your little satellite that you've bought for $900?
Well, that's to be determined. I assume eight of them will be integrated, and then they will go to either Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo. You can go to www.cubesat.org. That's where they're located. There's another company called ISIS in the Netherlands. There are multiple options. Even the government's offering some flights. I don't think NSF would do this, but NSF is currently sponsoring some triple cube sat flights that are doing scientific measurements.
So this is...
There are people who are brokers, David. There are coming in the middle who could be brokers to take on a number of very small satellites, assemble them in a package, and certify them, if you will, for the launcher.
Yeah, Cal Poly the cost used to be about $40,000 for a CubeSat. They would take CubeSats from various universities and companies, integrate them together on a Russian launch vehicle, and get them launched. Now that more American launch vehicles are in the mix, you know, prices are up around $100,000 or so for a 1U CubeSat. But Henry's right. There are companies that will take your CubeSat and find a flight for you as long as you've got the cash.
As always, cash rules. So are the CubeSats, can they now, with the technology of today, do really useful, important things?
Well, I'll start, and then Sikri could finish up. It depends on, they can do a lot of very specific scientific missions. One of the advantages of the CubeSat is you could put multiple satellites up in space. In some of the space science missions, we can put up very high-precision spacecraft, and we get one data point as that space vehicle goes around the Earth. So we have one point. One would like to get more distributed data points if you're measuring some environment like the magnetic environment or something else. So the CubeSats offer that, not at the same resolution as the precision spacecraft, but a lower resolution, but more data points. And so there are things that people are exploring that way. Are there other missions that could be done? Yes, store and forward communications. The amateur satellites have used something a bit larger than the CubeSat for years and have done store and forward communications. There's a chapter on that in the book. The history of the AMSAT is actually in the book. And so there are some things you can do. Now, the question is going to be what the CubeSat evolves into, and that's somewhat in the future, and which is part of the book that we have addressed in the back end, is imagine if the CubeSat itself is just a module, a smart module, then you can effectively couple those together and build larger spacecraft. Imagine this CubeSat as a Lego block. And so you can then basically couple them, bolt them together in space, and then build larger structures. And so that is an evolutionary process. I call it the generation after next, but there's no reason why these CubeSats cannot do that. But in the immediate future, there are some observation missions they can do. They can do cloud cover missions that are okay. There are some things that they can do, yes. Siegfried?
Yeah, I mean, in principle, you can get at least 10-meter ground resolution from a CubeSat for like a 3.5, 4-inch diameter lens that you can fit on one. So there's a lot of Earth surface monitoring you can do with that. It's not the high-resolution stuff. You're not going to identify cars or people, but you will see fields. You can look at different wavelength ranges for monitoring the state of vegetation. You can monitor fires. With our AeroCube 3 that's presently in orbit, we could see the smoke trails from the massive fires in the Los Angeles area a month or two ago. And the Army bought 8 triple-length CubeSats, so they intend to use those for communications purposes. So you see there, they do offer a bit of functionality in an operational sense, but typically they're research devices.
Is there a debris problem with putting lots of these smaller satellites up, or do they decay and take care of themselves on the way down?
Go ahead, Siegfried. You start.
Okay. Well, there can be a debris problem. There are, I forget how many thousands of objects are being tracked right now in low Earth orbit. But it turns out there are multiple protected regions around the Earth. Low Earth orbit's one of them, geostationary orbit's another, where you do want to kind of limit how many spacecraft are there. But there are other regions that are more wide open where you don't worry as much. Those tend to be nasty environments, like in the middle of the Van Allen radiation belts. But in general, CubeSats or other satellites, if they're launched at up to a couple thousand kilometers or so, they will come down. The length of time it takes to come down depends on how high you go and the characteristics of the satellite. A typical 1U CubeSat, for example, if you drop it off at about 700 kilometer altitude, will take about 20 to 25 years to come down. Some of our close to CubeSat-sized vehicles that were ejected from the shuttle, these are called MEPSIs, MEMS-enabled picosatellite inspectors, those came down about a year or less, simply because they're a lower altitude and there's more air drag. So right now the FCC determines whether or not you get a license to transmit based on whether you've proven that you can come down within 25 years. So I guess that's the ultimate answer to your question.
This is a related question from Peter in Salt Lake City, and he says most of the bigger satellites are required, or at least they're voluntarily carrying fuel on board to help them deorbit and come down to mitigate the debris problem. I suppose this is not possible with something like a CubeSat, or is there a way for the CubeSat to assist itself in coming down?
There is, and Siegfried didn't mention it. He's being a bit modest. The AeroCubes that we have, we've looked at blowing up a small balloon to look to increase the air drag. Space debris is a big issue, and we've been looking at it very seriously from our side. You do have to keep a little bit of pressurized gas, but calculations done at the Aerospace Corporation show that if you blow up roughly a 1-meter balloon, this is tethered to the CubeSat, then you can come down at as long as you're within the reasonable orbit, 300 to 500 kilometers, you can come down between 3 and 5 months. And so it is, you can accelerate that descent very quickly. And we're hoping that techniques such as that would be applied to future CubeSats. There's a chapter by Bill Ehler, who runs the department here. The Aerospace Corporation is to some extent responsible for tracking all these objects in terms of keeping them. There's about 13,000 objects that are now being tracked that are 10 centimeters and larger, and many, much more than that are smaller. We track them, so it is a big problem. Bill has been arguing here for years that we need to address this issue from the CubeSats. So we've addressed it. There are ways to do it. And the simplest is this tiny balloon. There may be other approaches as well.
Is that
there's a device called the Terminator Tether that's available from Tethers Unlimited.
Yep. Yeah,
they have a version that they claim will work on a CubeSat.
Is the balloon idea theoretical, or is it actually in operation now?
Let's see. We're going to initiate that within the next few months.
And
it's pretty straightforward. You blow up a balloon, the drag coefficient goes way down. Air drag dominates, and then you come down much faster.
Does it add much mass to launching the CubeSat?
No.
Not in our case, no. Because you don't need a really big balloon. You only need one 2 to 3 feet in diameter, depending on how high you go.
Bill in Boston sent in an email question for either of you. What does future technology hold for satellites in general? Will we continue to be launching the big giant buses, or will we be finding ways to get more and more out of smaller satellites, even if they're not the CubeSats or the nanosatellites, but still smaller than the big giant ones we have been using?
Go ahead, Siegfried. You start.
Okay, thanks.
You got the bill.
As Henry mentioned earlier, there's basic physics that tells you you need a big satellite to do some missions, and you're not going to get around that unless you start doing some clever things like breaking up your satellite into a bunch of smaller satellites. But in general, I think you're going to see big satellites, things that will transmit direct TV to your home or satellite radio to your car. But in the longer term, again, we can split those up into smaller satellites that function together as if they were a single large satellite. So that's one of the technologies we're looking at here at the Aerospace Corporation. Small satellites are going to continue to evolve just as Moore's Law and electronics continues to evolve. The small satellites we see 10 years from now will probably be more than an order of magnitude more capable than what we have today. Henry, do you want to continue with that?
I do want to add one point. I believe it's going to be the small satellites will evolve because there are missions that the big guys can never do. And he's Siegfried alluded to in terms of sparse aperture antennas and arrays. I mean, imagine an antenna the size of about a kilometer or 2 kilometers wide. It's just not possible to take anything that size in space. I mean, you just can't, regardless of how thin the antenna material is. However, if you had a distributed sparse aperture system set up and your small satellites were very intelligent that way, one could conceivably do that. And have very large aperture systems that are not even possible for the big systems that we have today. In the back of our cover, if you see the book, David, you'll see an unusual shape structure, which takes it even 50 years in the future, where very large structures could be assembled together in space as assembly of very small CubeSats or very small smart Lego blocks. And these are all put up in space. They have all their own propulsion, basically get together and make very large structures, which would be not even possible with current ideas about how to do with big systems.
And notice we put barcodes on the satellites.
I'm looking at the back of the book right now. So why do you have barcodes on the back of the satellites?
To show that they're mass-produced and they're just part of what you'd normally buy off the shelf.
So you could go to Radio Shack and buy that.
Well, maybe not Radio Shack.
Or Edmund Scientific or something like that.
The intent really is that they're mass-produced on some form of an assembly line similar to microelectronics or computer manufacturing technology. And so they are self-contained systems, and robotics is going that way to some extent as well. They're self-contained systems. They have their own internal intelligence power and some resource in terms of propulsion and attitude control, and they have very limited mission just until they bolt up to the next guy. And then once that's done, then the system works as in sort of a concerted fashion to do a very large, complicated mission. So the idea is to set up that manufacturing line, to set up what is the material, what is the foundry, what does the satellite manufacturing look like if you're really going to do something like this where you're talking about units of thousands and ten thousands.
Jamie in Boulder, Colorado, said if these parts are going to be basically off the shelf, if one thinks to the start of the computer era, nobody imagined having a personal or a portable computer, and now everyone does. Many people have them in the form of BlackBerries that are extremely small and fit in your pocket. Are we coming to a point where we will have individual satellites that we can program to our own programming, to whatever it is we want for news or entertainment, and we won't even have to take a feed from a larger satellite? Are we evolving to that point?
Go ahead, Siegfried. I can answer, but go ahead.
I don't think so from a single satellite. There are communications link issues involved.
Right.
You need a certain power level. You need a certain antenna gain in order to get the bandwidth you need. And when you're in space, the distances are long. You're going to need watts of power, very high gain antennas. Now, you could do that from an array of small satellites that are forming multiple beams at the same time. It's possible in principle.
Well, there is a particular area that I like to bring up that might be useful, but not on an individualized. It is possible to take a triple CubeSat, so that would be, you know, a 10 by 10 by 10 times 3, and to actually build it into what would be a small telescope, and then have astronomy clubs around the world be able to direct this little small telescope in space, having it available 24/7 to look at various things as a personalized telescope. Now, you know, it's not the Hubble, but it might be much better than being on the ground because you can stare at something for a very long time. So it's not what you were getting at, but it does open the opportunity for various clubs that might be interested in astronomy, maybe one.
Interesting. But there already are, I mentioned during the break, and not to dwell on it, companies that say for $8,000 or $9,000 they'll let you launch or build your own personal satellite, and it'll hang in orbit for anywhere for 3 weeks to maybe 2 months and transmit back to you. I mean, I don't know where they're getting the bandwidth from to even have it transmit back to you. Is that just a novelty, assuming that they can actually pull that off? Let's assume it's for real for a moment and not go down the other road. Is there any? It's hard to imagine someone could launch their own personal satellite and have it talk to them, and they could get bandwidth to do that. Any comments?
Well, clearly, okay. The bandwidth is an issue. I'm sorry. Clearly, the bandwidth is an issue. You have to deal with that, and there's so much of it. The cost is not an issue because there are plenty of people who have the resources, cash wise, to put up, as you say, their personal satellite. It is the bandwidth, and that's something the international or the FCC organizations will have to address about how to do that. There are people who have done that as a club. The amateur satellite in the United States and globally have managed to put satellites up and have a number of people use them. They're not personal per se, but, you know, it is part of a club, so to speak. Bandwidth is going to be that issue.
Yeah, and also, you know, what good is this personal satellite going to be to the user? You're going to have, it'll probably be in low Earth orbit, and orbital mechanics dictates that you're probably going to see this thing for a maximum of 10 minutes, maybe 3 or 4 times a day. And I think that's going to be disappointing to a lot of people. You know, it really has to provide something unique, like special space measurements, or maybe take pictures of your house from space, which you won't be able to see because the resolution won't be high enough. It's just hard to see what's going to drive what's going to drive people to want their own personal satellite at that scale.
Yeah, it's going to spy on another business or their spouse or something like that. But
I was going to go there, but I didn't want to bring that up because companies can do that. But I figure encryption codes are sophisticated enough right now that I can use the standard communication media systems to get or protect myself. But, yes, that would be one way around.
So you could do something like that to invade privacy if you had the technical skill to do it. Interesting.
It'd be easier to do it on the ground.
I'm sure it would, and you'd get better resolution with a camera on the ground. are you guys really optimistic? Are you looking at a future technology on a short timeline of big jumps or just little incremental movements? Are we looking at transforming our information and data services and the way we do things because of the advances in satellites and especially the smaller satellites?
Siegfried, you go ahead. I'll talk about
sure.
the glass.
Okay. Yes, I think we're going to see an evolution of space technology. The big difference is that these are small satellites. You can get them. They don't cost a lot to build compared to conventional satellites. They're cheaper. And the main thing is the time scales are much shorter. We build our AeroCubes in about 2 months. If you factor in the design time, testing time, and all that, you can do it in 5-6 months. So we can launch, if we can get satellites launched on, say, a 9-month schedule, we have enough time to design, build, test, fly, get flight data back, and redesign the next one. And that's really the key change here in the way space technologies can be evolved. Typically, it takes years, 5-6 years, to get an experiment into space, and then you get your data back, and then, okay, I got to design the next one. So the CubeSat paradigm really accelerates that by a factor of 6 to 8. And that's where we see the advances coming. You've got a lot of universities out there doing things that typical aerospace engineers wouldn't think of doing because they think it's too risky. Some of those are going to pay off. We're going to see some very interesting developments in electronics and sensors. I say let the students go at it. Let all of us keep working at it as fast as we can. And the real key is just maintain the funding level or maintain the level of resources necessary to keep a steady stream of innovation going. And then you'll see big payoffs in the space field.
Let me interrupt you here because we're going to break now from KKNW in Seattle. And for those of you listening in Seattle, we will be back on the air next Monday, same time. You can hear the rest of this program if you're at a computer. Go to www.thespaceshow.com. Click on Listen Live. Otherwise, the program will be archived later this evening, and you will be able to pick it up for infinity. So thank you all for listening in Seattle. Everybody else, stay right where you are, and we'll be back with a special edition in 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. You are listening to The Space Show, and we're talking today about the book and the subject, Small Satellites, Past, Present, and Future. The two editors of the book are with us, Dr. Siegfried Janson and Dr. Henry Helvagian, both of the Aerospace Corporation. And Henry, you're going to give us your comments on that question we were talking about at the end of the last segment on are we in for sort of an evolutionary era because of the technology advances in CubeSats and small satellites?
Yes. Siegfried made a very good presentation about the fact that there is an evolutionary approach to, and the CubeSats are accelerating that by getting quicker access to space, various tests. But independent of that, the Aerospace Corporation, at least, and I'm sure other centers, are also looking at revolutionary. And in that regard, I'd like to bring up one thing that we have been working on here, which is also in the book, that is addressing this issue of mass production. And the mass production is an easy word to say. You know, what do? You mass produce it, so you set up an assembly line, something looks like it could be a Model A Ford assembly line. Well, that's not altogether correct. We've taken many steps back from that and addressed, as I said, what should satellites be made of and how best can we mass produce the spacecraft necessary. And so in that regard, we've looked very hard at the satellites, the CubeSats, and the larger ones are mostly made out of metal. And the question is, can we get rid of metal and replace it with another material that will allow us to be able to integrate more systems into the infrastructure of the satellite? Currently, the metal serves as basically a scaffolding of which other sensors are added. Can you replace that? Now, Siegfried addressed that 10 years ago, I'm almost 20 now, by replacing it and saying, let's make it out of silicon, and silicon does work to some extent, but there's a limitation. What we are doing here at Aerospace is looking at glass. It's a glass ceramic. It's a photosensitive glass ceramic material. Uses all the standard lithography tools that microelectronics people would use, except for you can shape the glass, you could mold it and shape it that you can't do with silicon. And all of the technologies that are used to fashion the structure are plastic forming or glass forming structures, which are very, very cost effective or reasonable rather than just mill tool machining. The advantage of the glass also, and we've tested parts of this in space in terms of materials compatibility and low Earth orbit and all those things are perfectly fine, is that the satellite begins to not look like a cube or a box, not necessarily. It could look like what the primary mission is. So if your primary mission requires a giant dish antenna, then the whole thing could be integrated into the dish antenna. It's a flying glass antenna, except for it's covered. If it's a lens, it could be a large aperture, and it's a glass. The glass allows you to integrate photonics and electronics and structure all in one material by various techniques that are available to us these days. It's not so possible with metal, aluminum, for example. In the case of the glass, it's also going to be lighter than metal. It's space. It's not a problem because it's a composite material. We've flown these things in space. So there is both an evolutionary and a revolutionary aspect to this. And the Aerospace Corporation is looking at both of them. Obviously, the structures that I'm talking about with glass are many years down the road, maybe 20, 30 years down the road. And so we really think that this material could actually also change how satellites are made in the future.
Are other countries doing research and studying and looking into these issues the same as aerospace and others in this country?
Well, I think I can answer that with regards to spacecraft systems, they are. I believe we are one of the few that is actually looking at it many steps behind in terms of going back to the beginning and saying, let's change altogether the material and the whole design. I think we're one of the few that actually is gone to that stage and have been promoting it and looking at the technology and how to do that. There's no question that there are other countries that are doing revolutionary technologies. I mean, people are actually the SuriSat, the Snap One vehicle, was revolutionary in itself. The first little 6-kilogram vehicle that Surrey Satellite Technologies put up 6-7 years ago now, and that was revolutionary in terms of where it stored the fuel and how the power was stored. But these were novel approaches to using a manufacturing technology that is commonly done in the satellite industry right now. We want to altogether change the whole thing from the beginning, and so that a satellite manufacturing looks very much like a computer manufacturing with circuit boards and lithography machines and place and pick machines, all these things that are robotically activated.
Your book is 800-plus pages, and it has a very specific order in how you put it together and what you're trying to cover. So let's spend a few minutes and talk specifically about the book, okay?
Okay. Siegfried, do you want me to start, or you want to jump in here?
No, sure. Go ahead.
The book is 850 pages, and it could have been much, much longer. And we were really trying to keep it a reasonable size. And we are very thankful for the many organizations that actually contributed freely to this book, 24 chapters, as Siegfried said. It is attempted to basically look after 50 years of where the small satellite industry has been and where we're going. And so the book is organized in it has a historical aspect of it. The first four chapters attempt to look at the from the beginnings to what then Siegfried talks about how we got here. And then there's, of course, in the United States, there was an attempt to bring back miniaturization with DARPA leading the charge with Clementine and the CubeSat invention with Bob Twiggs. So that is the historical aspect, if you will, with AMSAT being there as well, the history of the AMSAT. We were very fortunate to get that. Then the bulk of the book is a number of organizations that contributed where they're actually making CubeSats or microsats. And this starts from the schools, the various centers that are actually doing as an educational tool for the CubeSats, to organizations like NASA and the AirCam, which is a robotic vehicle that's supposed to help us astronaut in space, to the European Space Agency on the technology developments on the probe, and to the Japanese programs in making miniature spacecraft, and some of the other universities that can actually make a somewhat substantial satellites in terms of they are of a higher quality than what would find for student-built projects like the SuriSat. So we are very fortunate to get the history of the SNAP-1 and the SuriSat program. We have a Technical University of Berlin's contribution. We have one from Canada, University of Toronto. And then we go into the technology. The last nine chapters deal with the future and technology, and so we addressed issues of, okay, if we have a number of small satellites, what missions are possible, and formation flying becomes a possibility. So we are fortunate to get some calculations and experiments that are being done at MIT today about how to do formation flying. We have the issue of, if you have a small satellite, what should the satellite look like so you could be seen from the ground by radar stations who assist you and give you your coordinates. So there's a chapter on tracking on how to do that. The space debris issue has been discussed already, so that is an attempt to sort of wake up the community to the fact that you need to be aware that you are going to be space debris unless you do something about it. And then there are a number of very far-out missions that we've been addressed at the back end, which is attempting to look at mass production, where the potential for miniaturization is going, which obviously is going to be far more sophisticated in the future, and how that could potentially be applied to making very sophisticated satellites, or at the end they could just be multifunctional modules which themselves are put together like Lego block style to make very complicated systems. We're not the only people thinking along these lines, but this book tries to cover all of these things. In addition to that, there is a couple of chapters on space policy and space security. And so we know that CubeSats or small sats allow any non-spacefaring nation to start putting up satellites. Anybody who has a reasonable fund can do it, including, as we've been discussing, individuals. So how do we keep space secure, and how do we keep space safe, and so that it is available to everybody else? And those are issues that are addressed from one perspective by one of the chapters. So I just wanted to make sure that we understood all of these aspects at this 50th anniversary of this, so that's why the book is somewhat larger. As I said, there are a couple of things that are missing from the book, and as you develop this thing, it was a two-year ordeal for Siegfried and I to get it out on time. There are many things we missed. And robotics is one. We could have had chapters in robotics and a number of other missions that were going on during this two-year time frame could have been included. So I'm hoping that there is a follow-on book by another organization, another perspective that gives us the fact that small satellites aren't going away. They're becoming much more prevalent, and they're going to be much more useful to the common person, whether it's a club, personal if you can afford it, but clearly schools and small organizations will be able to put those up for whatever things they want to do, including space science. So, Siegfried, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, a little bit. I think you may not have mentioned the chapter on picosatellites at the Aerospace Corporation, That's written by David Hinckley, and it covers the history of small satellites here at Aerospace in terms of things that we've flown. We've flown over 12 small satellites, and we have one on orbit now that I mentioned before that's been operating for 5 months. We're going to continue building more in that series. I'd also like to mention that, we've also been thinking about the future. We wanted to look, we looked 50 years into the past, and, what kinds of things do you expect 50 years in the future? One thing that I included in my chapter on the future of small satellites is the use of small satellites as propellant. We talk about smart structures. If you can mass produce these things in lots of tens of thousands or more, and my preference is to make them out of silicon because I can make them just like integrated circuits, and I'll probably bond some glass units onto them to make them even more functional. But the bottom line is, if you can recycle the propellant that you eject from a spacecraft, the tyranny of the rocket equation is broken. And it turns out there are ways of doing that, and I just put one of them in the book. So that allows you to recycle stuff you throw out, and basically you can get more mass where you want to get it.
What chapter is that where the tyranny of the rocket equation is broken?
Chapter 23.
Chapter 23?
Yeah. I mentioned raising an orbit by doing this, what's called an apogee reflection maneuver.
Interesting.
But you see, the bottom line is we already spend $5,000 per pound, or roughly, to get something into low Earth orbit. Why not spend $1,000 per pound and make something that's intelligent that you can get back to you and you reuse many times? It's kind of like, if you're standing in the middle of a room on a frictionless surface board and you've got a baseball, you can throw the baseball and you start moving. But if you bounce the baseball off the wall and keep catching it, you can move a lot faster.
Are we moving in these directions, or are we talking about a theoretical future?
That's a theoretical future. First, we want to look at the orbital mechanics involved, see if it really makes sense for things like near-term lunar missions or going to Mars, or even I'm looking at satellite rephasing using these concepts, moving satellites around within their own orbits.
It's
theoretical. It's not experimental at this point.
It is going to be an exciting future, though.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, and I've got a couple of more questions that I want to bring up, but it appears to me that we're going to need an awful lot of really bright, cutting-edge engineering and related people coming out of our schools. We're constantly bombarded that we have an engineering dilemma and problem in the United States, and our STEM education is in the tank. From your vantage point, are you seeing a shortage of well-trained, qualified engineers? Are we okay in terms of the pool of talent to lead us into this future, or are we showing up with deficits?
I can give my opinion, and Sheik can give his. My opinion is that at the moment, there's a shortage from where I see it, and we're both Siegfried and I are in the R&D organization at the Aerospace Corporation, research side of the house.
Uh-huh.
So I'm seeing a shortage, but I have also seen the spark in the eyes of people who get to play with CubeSats. And so the fact that the CubeSat technology and the SmallSat technology allows a student, a graduate student perhaps, or an undergraduate if necessary, to have a hands-on experience is going to change, and you're going to see much more people going toward that direction. I have sensed from other faculty at these various academies that they are seeing that the number of people signing up for space science or space systems classes is growing, but it's a matter of getting them to actually have hands-on involvement. Imagine if you were a student and you gave all the theoretical about what satellites do but never get a chance to build one. That doesn't work. But that's changing, and thankfully it is a small satellite that's doing it. So I think the future is good, but at the moment we're still in the sort of test. Siegfried?
Yeah, I'm not sure of the exact numbers, but I believe that the science, engineering, and math the number of majors being produced per year in colleges has been declining. I think space has always had a special fascination for people, and as Henry said, CubeSats help pull a lot of more students into the space field. The truth is, you know, if you want to get a job in the space field, at least when I did it 20-some years ago, electrical engineers had just as much a chance as aerospace engineers. So it's a multidisciplinary field. We're going to have to pull people from wherever we can, and I think we'll continue to do so. The small satellites definitely help. I mean, I was doing electric propulsion research, and I started learning more about satellites because I started listening to the University of Surrey satellites that were on orbit at the time. Once you start hearing, you know, once you get data from space, and those, you know, some of those early satellites had digital talkers on board, they'd give you the temperature, you know, number two is -3 degrees. It was very simple to get data off the satellite, and once you start doing that, you start thinking, wow, how can I predict when the satellite will come overhead? And you just learn more and more about satellite systems to the point where you can start building one.
You have this question from Linda, who's in Evanston, Illinois, and she says it's for either of you. And she says, you mentioned space policy a few minutes ago. With the advent of CubeSats and smaller sats, I would imagine the barriers to entry by players from all over the world are greatly reduced, especially on the engineering and the cost side. Are we going to see a complication of effective space policy because of the low-cost ways countries and perhaps even corporations can get up into space and maybe do their own thing, interfering or transgressing on space policy? Is this going to be a complicating factor for nations to consider and factor in over the future to how they develop space policy?
We normally don't cover space policy because we're the technical end.
Right.
You know, I think it's just going to depend on how many satellites get launched and who does what. But beyond that, really can't say much.
It will affect to some extent, yes, of course. The chapter in our book, not by an aerospace engineer, addresses this issue from the perspective of large satellites, about how do you set up a constellation of large satellites. And there are familiar things that could be done. NATO is an example where is used in the chapter where a number of nations buy into a sort of a club, and they all put up various satellites. This is nothing new. Surrey Satellite Corporation has been doing this to develop small constellations. But to answer your question, honestly, yes, the space policy will have to accept the fact that small satellites now can be launched by anybody who can get a launch vehicle. So that has to be addressed, yes.
So they've broken down the barriers to entry, so it's much
right.
more of a wide-open field.
That's right.
It's going to be a real interesting future that unfolds because of technology, isn't it? Adam has this question for you in Tucson. You mentioned a few minutes ago electrical engineering. If one wants to get involved in this type of research and hands-on activity as a career, CubeSats and SmallSats, what is the best academic path to take? Is it electrical engineering? Is it aerospace engineering? What do you recommend?
I recommend aerospace engineering with a minor in electrical engineering. I mean, if you look at it, there are three main drivers to why small satellites suddenly have a rebirth within the last decade. And, you know, one is solar cell efficiencies have gone up, so you got a lot more power on small satellites. Another one is battery technology has advanced. We now have lithium-ion batteries where the energy density is really high. And the third is that we just have much better electronics. Memory storage on a CubeSat is not an issue anymore. You can buy 8-gigabyte micro SD cards. They're about the size of your fingernail, and that holds more than enough data for a small satellite. Computational capability is continuing to evolve, so electrical engineering plays a key role, and I think any satellite designer needs to understand basic electrical engineering and certainly needs to understand RF communications links if they want to be a good spacecraft systems engineer. Henry?
Yes, no, I agree with Siegfried. I would add to it software systems and in the future, not in the near term, in the future, other disciplines like robotics, I believe, is going to be of interest. Satellites becoming more of a robot that effectively does a lot of its computation analysis on its own and makes its own assessments of situational awareness and all that. It's becoming a very smart vehicle. And so in that regard, it's essentially a robot and needs to work that way. And there's a lot of interesting science that could be worked on there.
But for students today, something like an aerospace engineering major with a minor in electrical engineering would go a long ways.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, they have to know enough math. to get not math light. What a fascinating world that is happening. You know, if we look at Moore's Law and the rapidity of how computer technology and technology in general is increasing, are CubeSats and satellite technology and related technology going to be increasing at the same intervals in the near future?
A few steps behind, we still have to deal with the radiation. So it's still, at least in low Earth orbit, higher orbits, it's a radiation environment. It's a harsh environment. So the technology, although that's being addressed here in a number of areas with silicon germanium as modifications toward that, but the bottom line is that it's just a harsh environment. You know, you can't take COTS and directly put it into space if you want something that's reliable in the long run. Short run, yes. Long run, perhaps not.
Well, we've seen over 40 years of Moore's Law, and even if you look back 20 years, there were a lot of people that were wondering, gee, can Moore's Law work for another 5 years? Can we get below the 1 micron barrier? It's a classic case of physics versus capitalism. Physics dominates. Capitalism allows you to buy amendments to those laws. I think my money's on capitalism. I think we'll see Moore's Law continue for at least another decade and see these advancements in satellites.
Fascinating. Yeah, it really is. Okay, so we're coming up on the end of the program. So first of all, if listeners have questions or comments for either of you, is there a way they can email you, or should they channel their email comments or questions through me and I get them to you both? How would you prefer to handle that?
Either way, our email is available. We, as a national laboratory of the U.S. government, set up by Congress, we're open to business to answer anything to anybody. So we're open.
Okay, and here's the kicker.
Taxpayers' money, so...
Taxpayers' money, that's right. And, well, we know about taxpayers' money. But you're not part of the stimulus package, are you?
No, we were around before the stimulus package. By the way, we're also going to celebrate our 50th anniversary next year. I don't know if that came up.
The company's
yes. Going to celebrate. Why was the company formed, and who led, politically, who led the creation of the company?
Well, you're going to have to go back, and I don't know the history. I can give you a quick synopsis. The former TRW, it was an organization here in the early 60s. My intuition from what I understand, and this is going to be not right, is that there was a conflict of interest of the engineers at the time who were evaluating proposals and then writing proposals at the time because the U.S. space industry had not gotten off the ground. So Congress decided to set up a national laboratory to separate these organizations, that new national laboratory. But rather than doing it like the other ones with the Department of Energy, for example, they established an organization that was a nonprofit in the state of California and set it up that way. And so there was one weekend where you were a member of one organization. The following weekend, you immediately became part of the Aerospace Corporation, and that's how it started. So we've been here and helping develop most of the spacecraft, not all of them, including the GPS and things throughout. So we've kept a very much of a low profile for the last 40 or 45 years, just laying low, doing what we had to do. So we're involved in every single launch. That's basically what Congress pays us.
Well, not so low profile when your president's on the Augustine Commission. So,
yes, that's
right. That's a lot of PR there. Gentlemen, I like to get closing comments and pearls of wisdom from our guest before we leave the show. And keep in mind that shows from 2001 are still listened to, so these have long shelf life. Do you have any pearls of wisdom for us or special concluding remarks? Who would like to go first?
Okay, I guess I'll go first. I've been at this, as Henry said, I started thinking of the Silicon Satellite in the early 90s. And I was a wild-eyed revolutionary for about 10 years, and all of a sudden I was being accepted as normal. And now some people say, oh, you're behind the times.
You sold out.
So, yeah, I sold out to CubeSat. The bottom line is pick something that you believe in. Keep fighting for it. And I think small satellites was a no-brainer, basically, because you have to look to history, and the trend said, you know, small satellites are going to come back in a big way. Henry?
Yes. I'll just add a sentence that opens our book. It's from Anatole France. I won't give you the French because I'm very poor reading it, but I'll give you the English translation. So it says, to accomplish great things, we must not only act, but also dream. Not only plan, but also believe. So we in this business have had to do all of those, as many others have also. But I felt that was an appropriate quote to take for all these people for many years who have been arguing that small satellites can play a role are now sort of on good graces, where for many years we were not on good graces. We sort of existed, and we knew we had to do something, and there are a number of people that have come before us who have given all this data. So we're very thankful for all these chapter authors who have allowed us a chance to put it together and make the claim that small satellites aren't going away. They're here, and they will be in the future.
And you never get a break. You don't ever stop doing that dreaming, do you?
That's right.
It's even on holidays. listeners, it is an excellent book. It's one of the top reference books on my shelves, and I'm sure it will be the same for you. Again, you can acquire the book a lot of places, from Amazon and a lot of places, but it is on the One Giant Leap Foundation website as an Amazon partner book for the Space Show. So if you do acquire it there, you help the Space Show out. So that's always something to do. And so you don't think you guys are going to write the sequel to this then?
This is my fourth. So my wife tells me this should be it, but you never know. So there's two other books on microengineering aerospace systems. Aerospace has been writing these books since 1993, promoting it. So we'll see.
At the rate things are evolving, we may have to start the next one next week.
revolutionary technology advancing quickly. Terrific. I want to thank you both for being with us today and for the great support of the Aerospace Corporation in putting this program together. And it's great work. I wish you both very high success with it. And for people who want to know about this industry, if they don't have this book, they're not going to really know that much about the industry. So this is it. So thank you both again for being on the show. And at some point, I hope we can do this again down the road.
Thank you.
Sure.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Listeners, that's it. Back live tomorrow night with our regular Tuesday evening Space Show program. Goodbye, all.